Please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Mr. Pitzer?
Here.
Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. Treese?
Present.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
And I'd like to welcome you to the December 2nd meeting of the Columbia City Council. We have minutes from the November 4th and the November 18th meeting of the City Council. For the November 4th meeting, are there any corrections or additions or deletions that you'd like to make? Is there a motion to approve the minutes as distributed? Motion made by Mr. Pitzer, seconded by?
Second. Last second.
Dr. Peters. All those in favor of approving the minutes as distributed indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Seeing none. For the November 18th minutes, has everyone had a chance to review them? They were distributed this morning before 9.
I would move the minutes.
Mr. Trapp has moved for the motion, moved for the approval of the minutes as distributed. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Ruffin. Thank you. All those in favor of approving the November 18th minutes of the Columbia City Council indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone of the contrary opinion? No. Seeing none, the ayes have it. Are there any adjustments to tonight's agenda? Excellent. I would move for the approval of the agenda as distributed.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Trapp. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Seeing none. Our first order of business tonight is a special item. If I could have Bill Moore come forward with the Columbia STEM Alliance. Mr. Moore, good evening.
Good evening. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Of course, I'm Bill Moore. I'm with the Columbia STEM Alliance. We're a relatively new organization. Columbia STEM Alliance, we're a network of educators, businesses, STEM professionals, okay, and volunteers. Our mission is to inspire interest and provide direct support for science, technology, engineering, and math education. First, I want to thank you for your participation and the funding that you provided. So the city did provide a $35,000 grant to us under an agreement. I believe it was signed in November of last year. Okay, so we have used those funds. I'll tell you a little bit of something about them and what we do with them. But we really believe that a solid STEM foundation, or STEAM foundations, as some people like to say, which we're great with that too, okay, really improves the odds of success for children and advances economic opportunity in our community. So one of the things we'd like to see is that more children, as they enter into their high school years, at least having it open as an option for them. We have too many children that actually go into middle school very excited about math and science and just everything, come out of middle school, and something happens in middle school, okay? But actually, it's pretty dramatic, right? We have about 15% of our kids that really are interested in much of anything as it has to do with STEM careers when they get out of middle school. And that's a really important time for kids to actually formulate kind of what they might like to be doing or be interested in as they get older. So in 2019, we actually engaged over 3,000 students, okay, in our summer STEAM programs, okay, in our Girls in STEM program, our after-school program, or extracurricular events. We have a STEAM bus, okay, that we actually use for special events. In fact, this year, we're using it in schools. In particular, we're using it at Jeff Middle School as they're trying to transition. And it's actually been a mobile lab that we're using over there for some of the stuff they're doing relative to in their design and manufacturing class. So we've used it a number of different ways. But we've got good participation in our programs. Our computer science program has probably been the one that's maybe had the bigger impact. There's a little thing, if you've got a sixth grader, you've heard of a thing called microbits, okay? And what we do, actually, Craig Adams is here with me today, and he's the brain trust here, But we actually introduced microbits into the school district, okay? And now they've adopted it as part of the computer science program. But we went in and actually taught these kids how to program. They're little microcomputers about that big, but they can hook them up and program them on their laptop. But what's really cool about it, after they program them, then they can hook up the motors and lights and other things and make them do things. So it's not only sitting at their computer, it's actually this hands-on thing. Take it a step further, then we use it in our summer camps where kids use to make robots, okay, and things that actually move. So kids will actually design and build a robot and then program it with their micro bits. So computer science has just been one of those really cool things that we've been very happy about. By the way, stop me at any time. I'm not sure I haven't done this before before you, okay? So please do if I'm moving too fast or whatever. So our students are designing computers, okay? They're using computer-aided design programs, so some CAD programs. And what's really neat, we've connected CAD with not just these beginner CAD programs that you can get off the internet, but these are programs that are tied into actual industry CAD programs that students will learn. And in fact, I have one student, okay, that it's not a Columbia public school student, he's over at Moberly, and he was taking a CAD class and he was really struggling with it. And he says, "You got any ideas?" And I said, "Well, yeah, we're using this program in our middle school students. Try it out, okay?" About a month later, I saw him. He said, "That was great. It was fantastic. It was such a good foundation, and I feel really good and really comfortable about it." So these are tools that kids are actually going to be using in the future. Some of them will choose to, and certainly will be useful. But along with those design tools, then we actually have actually taught kids how to actually use equipment. So this summer, we had a summer STEM at camp, and it's over at the University of Missouri with the Department of Agriculture. We brought in a lot of volunteers in the community, but we actually had these girls designing in a CAD setting, okay, but then they built their things using woodworking equipment. So we had these 12 and 13-year-old girls with big table saws, I mean, ripping stuff up and then building them. The thing, again, the confidence that came from them, okay, designing that and then coming with something they can hold in their hand and actually use, because it was a functional device that they designed, pretty cool, and it really felt good to see that. And it was similar in our summer STEAM camp, where they built movable robots or movable pets, those types of things. Funding, from a funding point of view, FUTURES funding is extremely important, so we really do support, appreciate it. But I want to let you know that for every dollar that you have provided, that's matched by community donations at a rate of about 8 or 9 to 1. Okay, so we do see a lot of really good participation from our local businesses. VU Foundation, a Shelter Bank, a Central Bank, Shelter Insurance, 3M Foundation, Schneider Electric, Cosmopolitan Clubs, and some of the community clubs around town, and then individuals. So I think we've kind of hit a nerve in the community as far as people wanting to actually support these types of programs. We have almost no overhead, okay, other than Craig. But it's all in instruction. I mean, really, we're not a pass-through, so if we're not involved in actually providing some service to children or students, okay, then it's probably not for us. I'm not saying we absolutely won't do it. And, you know, 95% of our funds are things we're actually engaged in and we're in the schools and working with teachers and students.
Thank you, Bill. Let me stop you there. Yep. And just see if there's any questions from council members at all. Did you have anything?
Well, my question was going to be, what's your total funding?
What's our total funding?
Do you know what your
Annually, okay, this year we'll end up spending about, you know, $125,000, okay?
Okay.
So,
And we provided, what, $35,000, so...
$35,000 this year, okay, and so we'll roll over some of that, okay. You know, for, you know, so it's, if you allocate it all this year, I mean, once it goes into our bank, we can't keep track of every penny, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, for instance, we have some programs for Title I school field trips, STEM field trips. We haven't completed executing those yet, and some city money is going into that.
Okay. I just was wondering what the match was. Okay. Thanks.
And is there any opportunity for teachers that may have a good idea or a grant request? Do you have an open submission or opportunities for teachers that may want to incorporate STEM in their classroom, even if it's an arts classroom or math classroom?
Oh, absolutely. We do have an application process, okay, and we have funded arts programs, okay, you know, we look at it, so we have a process where our board actually looks at applications and we try to evaluate them. And so we really like to be able to make sure we're adding some value, not just dollars, but certainly in some cases, a teacher has a $4,000 idea and she could do something really fast if we could provide her some funding, and we try to do it if we can.
Right. Yep.
What are your strategies for ongoing funding?
So what we do for funding is that it's, you know, we work with those foundations, and, you know, we approach our businesses in Columbia, okay, and we're going to, you know, those businesses that need tech employees, okay, or need employees, and say, listen, you've got to help us build our bench here in Columbia. This is a really important part of our economic development. And so, you know, we go to ready meetings and talk to people. And so that's got to be our major source of funding, okay? And, you know, I think the businesses in our community understand that, okay, and are responding fairly well. I think they will continue to respond. So, okay. So that makes sense, I hope.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the report and,
right.
and the numbers and the deliverables.
Appreciate it, guys.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Moving on to public hearings. Our first order of business will be, actually, we'll move on to old business. First item will be B31919. There is a request to have this withdrawn, but Madam Clerk, would you mind to read Bill 31919?
Council Bill 31919 is an ordinance rezoning property located on the northwest corner of the intersection of Green Meadows Road and Gray Oak Drive from District PD Plan Development to District MC Mixed Use Quarter, repealing all conflicting ordinances or parts of ordinances and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective.
And do we have a staff report, or I understand the applicant has requested this to be withdrawn?
Yes, sir, and I don't have anything more to say about it unless you have questions.
My only question was, why do we have any idea as to why it was withdrawn?
I don't know why it wasn't stated in the communication. They did not get staff's recommendation, and they did not get Planning and Zoning Commission's recommendation. So I just surmise that maybe they're going to look at possible other options, either a new request, less intensive zoning, or work with the existing planned district, which does allow some commercial use of the property.
Okay, thanks.
Without objection, any other questions? Without objection, Bill 31919 will be withdrawn. Moving on to Bill 34819, Madam Clerk.
Council Bill 34819 is an ordinance amending Chapter 29 of the City Code to establish use-specific standards governing the operation of short-term rentals and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
And do we have a staff report? Now, I will announce that it's going to be Council's intent, that I intend to make a motion to table this to the January 21st, 2020 City Council meeting. The Council is planning to have a work session at our first meeting in January, where we will get a staff report, ask any questions that Council members have, state any requested amendments that Council members may have. I'd like to have public input at that as well. At the January 21st meeting of City Council, we'll consider those amendments, again take public input on that, with a final vote on that at the first meeting in February. Is that everyone's understanding?
Good.
How many are here that may want to be heard on this item? Okay, a couple. Okay, why don't we go ahead and do a staff report, if you just want to maybe do a brief overview of where we're at in the process?
Yes, and I'll start by showing the tentative schedule, and I hope I captured the remarks of Council at last month's meetings, the work session, and the end of the regular session. This is what we understand will be the timeline after tonight. And just briefly, what has been presented to Council is a draft ordinance that amends Chapter 29. That's the Unified Development Code, so that's the zoning aspects of what we call short-term rental, which is Airbnb, VRBO, FlipKey, and other online platforms that people use to create an opportunity for people to stay in their house as a transient guest, to use the term that's in the draft ordinance. And conceptually, what the ordinance does is it permits short-term rentals in residential districts and mixed-use districts where residential is permitted, subject to conditions. and the primary condition for using a property as of right or by an administrative process, I should say, is that they be what we call owner-hosted. And that means that the owner of the property that is being offered for short-term rental uses that as their primary residence, and that's defined in the code what that means in terms of number of days of residence out of the year. There's also occupancy limitations that go with that. Anything that goes beyond a owner hosted with or goes beyond the maximum number of transient guests allowed would only be able to seek relief through a conditional use permit, which would be a case-by-case process of consideration by the Planning and Zoning Commission and the council. There are some additional standards for short-term rentals in multifamily districts or districts that allow multifamily housing. Primarily one short-term rental unit per lot that contains a two-family or multiple family building. And once again, if an individual wanted to go beyond that, they would have to seek that relief in the form of a conditional use permit. And the idea there is so that existing multifamily buildings do not turn into apartment hotels, that would be recognized that that's just for a partial use of that building. There would be a registration requirement. These would be entered into the city's rental conservation program. We'd create a separate type of certificate of compliance specifically for short-term rentals. They would be inspected for compliance with property maintenance code in similar fashion to long-term rentals. And short-term rental, by the way, is defined as having guests that stay 30 days or less. So that's the definition that's set in the ordinance. The business licenses will also be required, and at the January 6 work session, we'll provide an overview of some of these companion ordinances. It's Chapter 22 for the rental conservation law changes, and it is the business licensing chapter for business license. It is also proposed that they pay lodging taxes. As you're aware, the commission, after many meetings, work sessions, public listening sessions, and formal public hearings, came to a 3-3 vote with three members absent. But despite the stalemate, they did make a number of comments, and so we've tried to express in our written report on their behalf some of the takeaways, if you will, from this lengthy process. I'll break right there for any questions council might have.
Are there any questions by council of either the process or content at this point? I know we're going to get more information at the first meeting in January.
One question. You mentioned the companion pieces of legislation. Those have not been introduced yet, correct?
That's correct. With the
and this, when do you know?
Development staff, finance staff, and the law department have been working on those.
And when? What's the schedule for introducing those?
Do you want to? Okay. Mr. Caldera is indicating that they'll follow shortly after the Chapter 29 amendments so that they can be considered together at the end of your process.
Okay, so by the January 21 meeting?
Yeah, intro then and second read on February 3rd.
Okay.
Would be a good schedule, yeah.
Mr. Thomas.
Has there been any discussion of regulating non-owner-hosted STRs in the same way that guest houses or bed and breakfasts are regulated, and what are the arguments in favor or against that proposal?
Well, as I mentioned, a non-hosted, as defined in the ordinance, would be an instance where an individual could seek a conditional use permit for that. So that is how variety of short-term rental is regulated. Quite honestly, the commission, I think, while they split 3-3, I think there was some general agreement that what we ought to avoid as a community is a lot of investor-owned properties in neighborhoods, and that's why the emphasis is placed on owner-hosted. But since you mentioned the other similar
Sorry,
types...
I apologize, Tim. I think I asked my question wrong. I meant owner-hosted.
Oh, owner-hosted.
Occupant-owner-hosted.
Oh, yeah.
STRs,
okay.
The same as bed and breakfasts and guest houses.
Yeah, they are very close. The way the ordinance defines them, it's stated that the definition does not include traditional bed and breakfasts. The main difference is short-term rentals are usually a single unit, so there'd be a single group or household or individual making a booking, where in a bed and breakfast, it's rental by the room. And it's on different schedules, so rooms are turning over at different times during the week with different guests. So that's a main difference. And then traditionally, what I'll call the bricks and mortar bed and breakfast has outdoor advertising. Usually it's pretty subdued, but traditionally they put a fairly noticeable sign out there noting that their property is bed and breakfast. Those are handled by conditional use, but only in multifamily districts right now.
In the proposed STR?
Well, that's the way the code addresses traditional bed and breakfast. And there was some argument by some of the public making comments that we ought to treat short-term rentals as if they are bed and breakfasts, because there is a lot of similarity.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yes. Let me go ahead and open it up to the public if there's any comments, and I will just reiterate it is council's intent to entertain a motion to table this to the January 21st meeting. But if anyone would like to come provide some comments, particularly any questions you might want us to ask at the work session or how you might help inform our approach to this issue would be helpful.
All right. My name is Gail Plemons. I live at 17 Aldea. And tonight I represent the West Ash Neighborhood Association. We have been engaged studying this issue and the consequences for our neighborhood for quite some time. We support only hosted STRs in all residential neighborhoods. We're concerned about affordable housing in our neighborhoods. There is, as you all know, a shortage of affordable rental and homes for sale. Other college towns, such as Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Starkville, Mississippi, are already experiencing loss of affordable housing because of short-term rentals and game day rentals. We're concerned about losing the integrity of our communities. We know our neighbors and we look out for each other. If unhosted STRs are allowed in residential areas, there should be a limit to the number in each geographical area. No neighborhood or zoning category should be overburdened. Let me explain just a sec. That means if unhosted STRs are allowed, I'm still not sure whether they're going to be, and there's probably not this final decision yet, but if they are, there needs to be, such as in each ward, a limit. I mean, if there's no limits and the conditional uses are approved, then that means I could have six on my street. So we would advocate for limits and adequate notification for the conditional use application. Before crafting an STR ordinance, we ask that you review national data and generate more specific data on the local level. Some links are provided, and I sent you all an email with this as a resource for data gathering. Also consider requiring a business license for unhosted STRs. West Ash Neighborhood Association is supportive of the owner-hosted model in residential areas, but prefers unhosted STRs to remain in non-residential zoning areas. We understand that an abundance of STRs may generate an influx of tourism money as well as potential income for STR owner operators. However, we do not believe that this should come at a cost to the fabric of our neighborhoods. Thank you. We really appreciate your slowing down and your careful deliberation on this issue.
Thanks for your thoughtful, detailed comments as to what you will, and if not that, then this, and I appreciate that, and thanks for being engaged in the process. Okay. Good evening.
Evening. My name's Christine Gardiner. I live at 112 Anderson Avenue. I have been following the short-term rental issue very closely, as I could. Was very concerned about my neighborhood and what it could mean. So I very much appreciate that you have asked staff to research and bring back more information to you, and also have taken additional time with this, because it's quite a box that once it's opened, we will not be able to close it up. And as I was watching the process, I don't have statistical, but anecdotally, it looked to me like the breakdown was 5-1 opposed and unopposed to unhosted short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods at all. I haven't found very many people that when I say, what do you think about having a short-term rental next to you, have said, oh, that doesn't sound good. So as I saw it coming forward and it just kept rolling along, I really did feel like I had to do something. So I unfortunately had to interrupt the planning and zoning meeting, but I do take responsibility for that. But I want you to really recognize how seriously I take this danger to my neighborhood. I don't really trust conditional use. I only would like to see hosted residents, STRs, outside in commercial areas. Our residential neighborhoods really need to have neighbors living in the homes. An empty home is not a neighbor. Thank you very much.
And you would define the residential zoning category as R1 and R2?
All of them, even multi.
Even multifamily.
I mean, why would we want to have homes waiting for the next festival or game next to us? We wouldn't, really, would we?
What if, right, and so what if there was strict enforcement of those nuisances that you find unacceptable?
I've had the nuisances next to me on long-term rentals.
Okay.
They are not dealt with well. The police don't want to deal with them. You try to call someone in the middle of the night to take care of someone, there's nobody that's going to come. Honestly, and the way I would hear dialogue during the planning and zoning is this is a complaint-driven sort of thing. Well, people don't like to complain. I am a complainer, but many people do not want to do that.
I get plenty of complaints.
Well, I go to the person, I talk to them, but a lot of people can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to cause trouble. They don't want to have repercussions or revenge. They're afraid sometimes. So I don't feel it's fair. And I think right now, if you want healthy neighborhoods, this is clear. You know, a healthy neighborhood has to have people living in it.
And we can have this exchange later too, but I've had one constituent contact me saying they own a house in a neighborhood and the house down the street from them came up, or maybe even the one next door, I'm not sure, and they bought it to kind of protect their property values for a rental property. But the turnover and the wear and tear on a long-term rental property was so much, they turned it into an Airbnb, and now they only get 2 or 3 days of use on that per week, per month, whatever it may be. So there's less wear and tear, less cars on the street. What do you say to someone?
I don't think that will continue.
Okay.
I think we will lose homes to people who are really speculating and, like, owning 16 or whatever. You're not going to be able to stop this. I know that there's lots of these short-term rental places already that aren't even listed anymore. They have their customers. You will never even know about it.
And just go
so
directly.
It's already, mm-hmm. I'm saying, it's already, I think, causing problems in the neighborhood. You cannot have a neighborhood if the homes are empty next to you. What happens if we have a real serious disaster? We're going to be depending on the people that are in our neighborhood next to us when our power goes out or our roof is off or whatever, you know. So I just want you to seriously listen to the information that's going on around the world and around the country on this issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your help. Any further public comment? Can you enlighten us, Commissioner McMahon?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. my immediate goal is not, by the way, Michael McMahon, 607 Washington Avenue. My immediate goal is to not enlighten unless any of you have any questions, but just to let you know that I myself will be present for your January meeting, and I'm certainly available. I know the other commissioners are available to answer any questions. This was a very detail-oriented process, and as you can imagine, many of our committee members are upset, and I get that. They're upset on both sides. We took too much or we gave too much. And so, and I would suggest, as Ms. Gardner said, this is a research-driven issue, and I would suggest, and we did a lot of research. Ms. Gardner's last point about many of these are not even listed. You have to be on a list to know. Mr. Toohey and I, just so you know, and I won't go too far down these, you guys got a lot of this to do still. Staff found about 300 on the lists that you can find publicly. Mr. Toohey and I have been looking and counting in other lists. We both guess there are twice that many. So it's a thing. They're already here is one of the approaches we took.
Would you agree they should be regulated? Should they be banned first?
We would have a problem right now. And one of the things we looked at was what are other communities doing? New Orleans, because of their particular needs after Katrina, they saw this investment capital as a great boon, and they had a very open door. I'm going to go all the way to the end where we are today. New Orleans is in federal court. They opened the door very broadly, and then they realized, for some of the reasons that Ms. Gardner mentioned, from other reasons as well, they opened the door very broadly, extended a bunch of rights, and they realized that's not what they really wanted to do, and then they rescinded them. They immediately went to court in Louisiana, and I believe they're in federal court right now, and have been that way for a while. Because of that, there are issues in not just the college towns you mentioned, but towns throughout the United States, and watching these trends, and we've been trying to research to try to be fair. It's really worth paying attention to where the rest of the country is and where the courts are on this, because my concern was that I don't want to end up where New Orleans is. But we already have 600 of them. So I will certainly be available to any of you at any time. And I know the other commissioners will be as well. And I would strongly suggest you do any and all research you can.
Mr. Pitzer.
Did you find any similar college-type towns that had regulated it in such a way that most of the participants in the process were happy with the outcomes?
Councilperson Pitzer, I believe you're describing a fantasy land. To answer your question specifically, no, we did not. There are some that are more successful than others. I think the program in San Francisco works. That won't work for us. The massive amounts of money the city gave and the developers gave and the fees, we can't even play in that game. And they still have court problems in San Francisco. Some of this has to do with the national dialogue as it has changed. When these first came around, everyone was like, hey, this is great. And then we have people who have them next door, and then we have people who want them as investment communities and or investment possibilities, and those are both viable options. They really are. But what does that mean in our neighborhoods? You know, we have residential neighborhoods right now, and with some exceptions, the only business you can have in a neighborhood in Columbia, generally, a music business or a daycare or something like that, low footprint stuff. And mom and pop renting a room out, no one's got a problem with that. Someone owning 17 investment properties in a college town, we might want to carefully review that.
Did the Planning and Zoning Commission consider banning, say, corporate-owned Airbnbs versus LLC-owned and capping the number of LLC-owned at no more than two?
I will say that Mr. Caldera was very effective at counseling us on what we could and couldn't do. It's very difficult to draw lines, and people do try to draw lines. One certainly begins to question things when you see 12 LLCs listed with the same address or something like that. Some of our corporate customers are good customers. Some of our privately owned folks are not good business folks. It's certainly more difficult to find a corporation, in court than it is a private individual. It was my hope, and I think some of my other commissioners took this approach, that we would like to be a little more conservative right now to avoid hopping straight into federal court. Because, you know, Ms. Thompson can tell you, federal court is very expensive, is it not, Ms. Thompson? So caution and education, and no one's going to be happy. There are people here today who are upset at me, and I get that. But we really did try, and I would say with Mr. Teddy, though we did vote, to echo what he said, though we did split 3-3, we're really not that far apart. Some of those are philosophical issues, you know, business versus neighborhood rights issues, and they're close, but they're not overlapping. So, questions?
So when we did the Unified Development Code, council considered 43 different amendments on that. To put things in, take things out, do uh-huh. this, don't do that. My intent would be to aggregate all of these ideas, everything that Ms. Plemons said and everything that Ms. Gardner said, everything that you've said. If you want to provide me anything that planning and zoning considered, and my intent for either the first meeting in January or the second one probably would be to have some type of decision tree that we can all look at and say, do we all agree these should be inspected? Should they be banned? And if the answer to that is a majority of 4-3, then the decision's over. But if we don't ban them, should they be inspected? And if that passes, should they be taxed? And if that passes, should they be X all the way down through Z?
And I think that's a very constructive way to look at that.
All right.
And the answer to most of your questions was, except for the banning, is yes. We already have them. I think that's a very constructive way. Look where you're at, what you agree on. And even with the folks who very much disagree with you, the fellow who wants down 17, the person doesn't want one next door, it is not every element within the proposed ordinance that they disagree on. It's a few close ones. I will say this of Ms. Gardner, and this is not to disparage staff in any way. Enforcement is impossible. So we erred on the cautious side, so as not to put so much into, because this is a police issue or ONSC, Upper Office of Neighborhood Services issue. One doesn't have the time and resources, and one doesn't have the time and resources. And the one, there's a very famous one here in the grasslands. I'm not letting anything out of the cat bag. Not talking out of school here. They had 23 guests there on a regular basis, and they complained. And not to be too Marxist about it, but the wealthiest people in the city complained every day for 7 months before that thing was gone. And that was to enforce the existing laws and regulations. And so when people like Ms. Gardner or the neighborhood that I live in, honestly, sometimes we don't call the police when the gunshots happen because we figure they're not going to happen. So if there's a loud party next door, you know, and that's not to disparage the police, it's just that they're committed elsewhere. So that's the type of staff spoke of, these are enforcement issues and we shouldn't worry about it, but we do have to worry about it because it does come down to Ms. Gardner going, I've got this guy next door. And you've all had folks in your wards come to you and I've got this guy or this gal next door and they're X, Y, or Z. You know, so we were trying to be cautious, I guess.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for your presence. Any further public comment? Would anyone else like to be heard on this? Any other council comments before I make a privilege motion?
Question about process.
Yeah.
So you mentioned December or January 6th work session, you wanted to take public comment at the work session?
What do you think?
I wouldn't take them at the work session. I think that's the time for our questions. And I suppose if they have questions, but they're not going to be on record then. I mean, it should be sort of free flowing, I guess, but.
There's a lot of educated stakeholders here that I wouldn't mind to be able to look and say, Gail, what do you think about that? What does your neighborhood say about that?
Yeah, that's true.
If you're okay with that.
Since we're limited on time, though, I mean, we have a defined end time. Do we need some sort of structure to do that?
If we post it on the agenda, we almost have to have it. But if we don't post it, I think with council's discretion, we could ask for some public opinion on this.
We could also have a public hearing on the regular meeting agenda.
Could do that too. Well, we wouldn't because it would be tabled to January.
Unless we table it to January the 6th.
And then table it again.
Well, is there something that says we have to only have one public hearing on it?
No. And we'll end up having two because January we're voting on it at the February one too. Yeah. I get your point, Mr. Pitzer.
But I would sort of like to get like our opinion or more important, I guess, just to go through the whole thing and come up with the potential amendments. And I guess I'd rather have comments on that.
Okay.
Once we've got there.
And that's why I tried to coax tonight's comments as help us inform our approach on this and what questions do you want us to ask? And that would be similar to what I would expect at a work session, but we don't have to have it as a formal agenda item.
And I'm happy to have people. I mean, I guess as long as we get our questions answered to have comments at the work session if we've got time.
Okay. All right. I would make a motion that Bill 348-19 be tabled to the January 21st, 2020 meeting of the Columbia City Council. Is there a second? Seconded by Ms. Peters. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The ayes have it. Madam Clerk, could you read the consent agenda and then read the consent agenda again and call the roll?
Items on the consent agenda include bills 349-19, 350-19, 351-19, 352-19, 353-19, 354-19, 355-19, 356-19, 357-19, 358-19, and resolutions 168-19, 169-19, and 170-19. Bills 349-19, 350-19, 351-19, 352-19, 353-19, 354-19, 355-19, 356-19, 357-19, 358-19, and resolutions 168-19, 169-19, and 170. Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
Mr. Pitzer.
Yes.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Mr. Treese.
Aye.
Mr. Ruffin.
Yes.
Mr. Trapp.
Yes.
And seeing no further new business, Madam Clerk, could you read the bills for introduction and first reading?
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Policy resolution 171-19 and bills 359-19, 360-19, 361-19, 362-19, 363-19, 364-19, 365-19, 366-19, 367-19, 368-19, 369-19, 370-19, 371-19, 372-19, 373-19, 374-19, 375-19, 376-19, 377-19, 378-19, 379-19, 380-19, 381-19, 382-19, and 383-19, first reading.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Moving on to reports. First report will be report 110-19. It is a staff report on the right of use agreements for sidewalk cafes. Has everyone had a chance to look at that? Anybody have questions or have heard from constituents on that? Anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, just that the reason for the report is these were frequently named examples during the process of amending the sidewalk cafe ordinance. And we told folks that made comments on them that that's really a separate process, that anything affixed to the sidewalk has to get council approval. So we thought we'd do a separate report just to inform the council on the enforcement mechanisms in those right of use agreements and permits.
And do those right-of-use permits have, are they, is there a sunset date on them? Can they be revoked at any time?
They can be revoked with reasonable notice, and I think in one particular case there's a six-month minimum, and then I think it's whatever law will say is reasonable. I would think a year before or a season before kind of notice, unless it's an egregious kind of situation.
So one of the things that struck me on page two of the report was one of the three kind of outliers, and we've looked at these sidewalk cafes and amended them and did a moratorium on them, and now we're kind of back to this, and it is what I kind of describe as, and what I've heard from constituents is the concern that what was described as an outdoor patio is now really operating as a three-season room, and what was intended to provide, you know, pedestrian access on the sidewalk really doesn't have the visible accessibility or sometimes the wheelchair accessibility that other ordinary sidewalk cafes have. And I probably would be inclined to refer this to the Disability Commission, or do we have a pedestrian? Bicycle and Pedestrian Commission, and maybe get their input on, are they fine? Is it a problem? Is it not a problem? And have them come back with just some guidance to council on that.
That seems appropriate.
I like that.
Yeah.
Any objection to that? So do we need a motion for that, or can we just send that report to the Bicycle and Pedestrian Commission and the Disabilities Commission just to provide some comment on next steps, if any, or additional enforcement, or including additional enforcement or revocation, whatever it may be?
Well, we'll inform the liaisons of your discussion.
Moving on to the downtown CID, you've received their letter, annual report, their financial statements along with their resolutions. And yeah, I know that the two executive directors are here. Any questions for the downtown CID? Anything you'd like to add? I appreciate your transparency.
Davis, downtown CID executive director. No, we are here at your beck and call, whatever we can do to answer your questions.
Have any recommendations on downtown sidewalk cafes?
So I think the last meeting that we had a couple weeks ago, you guys did well there, and I agree with everything you say with the more permanent type of structures.
Okay.
You have short-term rentals downtown.
You do. let you know that.
Yes, we do have some downtown, and I think the newer ones are taking into account everything that was brought up earlier and should be rolling out more smoothly.
Anything else? Seeing none. Thank you. Moving on to final report. I saw the chief just walk in. The Citizens Police Review Board supplement to the 2018 report approved at their November 13th meeting, and looks like they've broken down some of their demographic data for complaints, et cetera. Any questions? Any comments? Any further action?
I just have some questions, I guess, mainly because I don't. When they talk about external complaint types, they say unfounded, exonerated, sustained, not sustained. What does that mean? I mean, the unfounded, I guess, means if there's a complaint that there is no basis for that. But exonerated, how is that different than unfounded? And sustained and not sustained? So I don't know if the chief can shed any light on this, or if this is something I should be asking.
I don't see the liaison to the Civilian Review Board, but I don't know, Chief, if you want to just comment generally.
So generally, if there was a complaint that we said was unfounded, events complained about did occur, but they didn't. It wasn't outside of policy. If they're exonerated, it just didn't happen. Not sustained is there's not enough evidence to show one way or the other. So those would be general categories.
Okay.
Hopefully that helps.
A bit, yes. What do you normally, maybe normally is the wrong word, but what type of complaints does the review board see? Is there any like set that you see more often than something else, or things that come up on a...
We had one for failing to investigate. We've had use of force go in front of the board. There's not a whole lot that goes in front of the board. It's generally members of the public, although officers can ask to take it to the board. I haven't seen that happen yet. Thankfully, there's not a lot of business.
That is a good thing.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
And final report is the
transfer of funds.
Any questions? Seeing none?
No.
Are there any general comments by the public? Mr. Conway, good evening.
John Conway, 4902 Thornbrook Ridge. I've gone back through and in preparation for the January meeting we're going to have about the water budget and the water rates to review some things. And one item that I found in my review that I want to point out to you prior to that meeting, and it has to do with the cost of service study. And and then I'll provide the city clerk a copy of this. And so the gist of it is that the cost of service study was to include the storage components of the water system in the analysis. And so when you look in the cost of service study, it was not included. And it's very apparent that we have a number of water storage facilities. Some of them are very visible, like the Walnut Tower and the Shepherd Tower, and then up north with the Stevens Station. And then there's a whole list of ground storage tanks also. And so anyway, that was not included in the study. And so if you stand back and look at that, it might, as it reflects on it, that you probably could come to the conclusion that the cost of service study is not valid because they didn't consider all the water system components.
Did you say a water tower is an essential component of the service system, both for water pressure and?
Oh yeah.
Why wouldn't that be included in the cost of service study? Why wouldn't that not be included in the cost of service study?
According to the Raftellis contract, under cost functionalization, storage lists to be included.
Had it been included in the cost of service study, wouldn't the rates have been predicated upon the cost to provide such existing or needed water storage facilities, which would have avoided a ballot issue for a new water tower?
I don't know about that.
Okay.
I would say probably not, because the storage was needed for, no, I would say that there was additional storage needed, Mayor, as well as the location of the tank and the strategic place
Got
to
it.
Increase pressures and flows for fire flow. Yeah.
Thanks for asking the question, or for prompting mine.
Then the second one that comes to mind is the fire protection cost functionalization in the 2018 water cost of service study. That what I want you to think about is very quickly that when you go into the cost of service study, that those costs for fire protection, okay, out of $18,392,638 of cost, that fire protection consisted only of $20,042. And then additionally, when they allocate the capital cost, that of the $5,824,589, there was only $115,404. Okay, so to me, that is underutilized allocation. And so let's think of it in these terms. Number one, due to the good work of the fire department and the water department, our good city receives the benefit of an ISO rating of 2. Which is really robust and great. And on a scale of 1 to 10, we only got one more to jump up to get to 1. And anyway, and so that affects the underwriting of insurance. and the citizens get that benefit, plus we get the fires put out. Okay, so what I want you to think about is, given those numbers, that given the size of the system, when you go east to west and north to south, okay, you're miles and miles, okay? So you start out at the well field with 18 wells, then the transmission line that takes it to the treatment plant, then they treat the water, then the high service pumps. There's two 36-inch mains that take it to West Ash. It goes from West Ash off the Bethel pump station, and then through transmission line makes its way to Walnut Street and so on. And so with a robust ISO rating of 2, these costs can't be realistic. It's not in proportion to how big the thousands of gallons of water that that system has to transmit to fight the ISO 2 fire in Prathersville. And you have to maintain that capability 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in reserve, okay? And so my point is that was needs to a second look at it, because it's just not proportional, and it's way out of, and so the idea, if you did that, went through and did a real cost of functionalization and cost of service study, that we pay $1.55 now, that it would be substantially higher. But in doing so, the idea would be that if we increase the fire protection cost, we decrease the other water rates to make it revenue neutral.
Okay.
But anyway, please take that in consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Conway. Any additional public comment? Seeing none, any comments by the members of the council?
I have a couple. First of all, you're all invited to a presentation by civil engineering students in Professor John Bowder's class, who have been researching universal transit access for student systems in Champaign-Urbana and Ames, and surveying students here at Mizzou, and interviewing the transportation and parking staff at Mizzou. And that's on Wednesday, 3 o'clock till 4 o'clock in Lafayette Hall. And Sheila forwarded the details of the room number and so on. Second thing, I forwarded to you after the last council meeting links to the CATSO long-range transportation plan update, which will be voted on by the CATSO coordinating committee on Thursday. And I'm interested to hear whether you had any responses, whether you feel that's an appropriate plan, or if there are any concerns that you have about it.
I'll make comment when you're finished.
I finished. Floor's open.
Sure. I've read the CATSO plan, and it's primarily lays out what easements we're going to acquire. So there are a lot of projects that we don't have the money to build, but I think it gives us a guidepost for what roads we're going to require that gets built in development, whether it takes 40 years or 100 years, that we're probably going to build out to those levels, whether we're driving electric cars or whether we're, you know, bicycling, we're still going to need those interconnections that are probably going to be very similar to the roadways that we're doing now. So I think that that's not a promise that we're going to complete all those things, but it's just kind of a map that guides us mostly on where we want to acquire easements and right of way. And for that, it serves its purpose. I think that does reference other plans. It does reference the Climate Action Adaption Plan. We might want to, you know, we might slow down as we change those things. But I think it's an iterative document, and when we look at its next review, it can, if we can harmonize it more with Climate Action Adaption Plan and if we want to make changes. But I think for where we're at right now, it's not an unreasonable thing. It's not a commitment that we're going to do those hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of road expansion projects. It just tells us, you know, what roadway we want to pick up as the city moves in those areas.
Thanks, Mike.
Any further comment? Any other comments by council? Anything else? Anything? I make a motion, we adjourn.